Once again, the fate of this economy rests on you, the humble American consumer. Don't look at me. I don't make the rules. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday today, I do believe, the 15th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I know, it's not always fair, the load that is put on consumers in this economy. But somebody's got to do all the spending, and that, gang, is us. Retail sales figures came out this morning, which is to say us buying stuff at physical stores and online, bars and restaurants as well. Down 1.3% April to May, with especially big drops for some big-ticket items. Now, you'd think, with where we are in reopening, a backslide in retail would be a warning sign of trouble to come, maybe. Or maybe not, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
So I'm just back from a week of vacation. First time I've flown anywhere, Portland to Tampa to New York, and first time I've seen my aging parents since the pandemic hit. For my trip, I got a haircut, airline tickets, and a rental car. All spending that isn't counted in today's retail sales report, says Ted Rossman at creditcards.com.
This report mostly measures good sales,
like cars, computers, appliances, which consumers spent a lot on when government relief checks arrived earlier this year. But Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics says as the economy reopens,
consumers are shifting from buying stuff to buying things like going to restaurants, ball games. I went to my first movie, you know, in about a year and a half.
In fact, clothing sales surged in May, which Ted Rossman says is also a sign of this move to doing stuff.
People are sprucing up their wardrobes, they're going back to the office, getting invited to events again, including weddings and graduations and family reunions and things where they want to look nice.
The return to spending on a wide variety of consumer services is coming in fits and starts. Chris Jackson at polling firm Ipsos says people are increasingly confident as vaccination spreads, but
it's important to remember that most people aren't light switches where they just switch on and off. And they do still have very sort of real concerns. So they're taking baby steps back into the world.
It's likely to be some time before all this consumer behavior shifting is done, and we can trust a single monthly retail sales report to tell us what the economy's really doing. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
I know y'all are sick and tired of hearing about inflation and the Fed and Jay Powell. I get it. I really do. But ahead of Chair Powell's press conference tomorrow, there is something I want to make sure you're up to speed on, because you're going to hear about it a lot tomorrow as the prospect of inflation and higher interest rates dominates the economic news. Something called the dot plot.
It's a communications tool for the FOMC.
Thomas Lawrence is an assistant professor of finance at the NYU Stern School of Business.
I describe it as FOMC members trying to throw arrows at a dartboard and hit it where they think the center is.
That's fair. It's literally a chart with dots on it where members of the Federal Open Market Committee, that's the FOMC that Professor Lawrence was talking about, it's where they make their guesses about when interest rates are going to start to go up.
The Fed dot plot allows the Fed to communicate disagreement or perhaps uncertainty about where the Fed funds rate will be in the future.
Yes, it's a little bit of Kremlinology, some tea leaf reading. Welcome to my life. But it does help us get a sense of what people other than Jay Powell are thinking about interest rates and when they start going up. Wasn't nothing going up on Wall Street today. I mean, there was, but it wasn't the major indices. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. At the risk of belaboring the point, which I've kind of been doing since like last Friday, there has been a whole bunch of economic news come out of the ostensibly political gatherings over in Europe this week. The latest, News this morning that after 17 years of arguing over how much government help commercial airplane makers ought to be getting, there is now a truce, a 5-year suspension of tariffs and subsidies. It is a turn of the page in U.S.-European economic relations of a sort. But it's also a chance for the two sides to change their focus to a new aviation competitor that is also spending billions in subsidies on a homegrown airplane company. Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
The U.S. and Europe may fear a growing China, but with commercial jets, the Chinese face many challenges. For one, its full-size passenger aircraft, which could get certified this year, relies heavily on imported technology, says Scott Kennedy, a think tank scholar at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Everything on that plane that keeps it in the air is either from the United States or from Europe.
Another challenge, maintenance and service. Here's consultant Kevin Michaels at Aerodynamic Advisory.
The hardest part isn't making the physical aircraft. These are productivity machines that must operate 365 days a year.
That is why most countries that tried to join the Boeing Airbus party have found themselves grounded. Richard Bitzinger is a senior fellow at Singapore's Nanyang Technological University.
The Koreans have tried to do it, the Japanese, the Russians. I mean, it's an elephant's graveyard.
Now, in an optimistic scenario, a Chinese plane could sell well in the next few years in the China market, forcing out Boeing and or Airbus. Today's truce between the U.S. and EU could let the two governments counter Beijing's tactics together, says Chad Olant at the RAND Corporation.
Without the common agreement between the U.S. or Europe, either of them individually has very little chance of holding China accountable.
Historically, Olant says commercial aviation has only had space for two big manufacturers. So, if Boeing or Airbus slip up in the future, that could create an opening for China. Keep in mind, China has succeeded in electronics, bullet trains, and going to Mars. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
I know, sometimes you wake up, you have to know right then and there what's going on in business and the economy. Check out the Marketplace Morning Report. David Brancaccio and the gang getting out of bed, figuring out what's going on, and telling you about it. Check it out. We are, give or take, 6 months into the Biden administration. As good a moment as any, really, to check in on where some of the promises that candidate Biden made stand now that he's got the job. What about, say, healthcare? As with many other things, it is not just Republicans that Mr. Biden has to placate. More than 150 House Democrats are out with a letter calling on the president to do more on one part of the healthcare system in particular, expanding access to Medicare, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
In President Biden's budget proposal, he calls for lowering the eligibility age for Medicare from 65 to 60. And there's research explaining why many advocates see that as a good idea. Joe Strager is a professor at Stanford School of Medicine and a surgeon.
And as a surgeon, I noticed in my practice that there seemed to be a sudden rise in the number of lung cancers I was treating in patients who had just turned 65.
He asked around, and his colleagues saw the same thing. Normal rates at age 64 and 66, but twice as many lung cancer treatments at 65.
And there's no biological explanation for why there would be that kind of jump.
But as Schrager found in a research paper he co-authored with colleagues, there is an economic explanation. People were waiting for treatment until they were eligible for Medicare. Schrager says lowering the eligibility age could save lives because that period of time in your early 60s.
I think it's a window where our sort of work associated insurance system tends to fail a lot of people. And it's the same window when illnesses that are life-threatening become more and more common.
And conditions that aren't life-threatening as well. Judy Stein runs a Center for Medicare Advocacy. Her group works with clients to ensure they receive Medicare benefits.
And they come to Medicare sicker, more vulnerable than they might had there been adequate coverage before they came on to Medicare.
Lowering the eligibility age may sound simple, but like anything else involving healthcare in this country, it isn't. For example,
providers generally get paid less under Medicare than they would from an employer plan or a private insurance plan.
Tricia Newman is a senior vice president at the Kaiser Family Foundation.
And so I think if this proposal were to move forward and gain steam, it would not be a surprise to see serious opposition from the hospital industry and other healthcare providers.
Having more people on Medicare would also shift the cost burden of insuring them from employers to the government. Miriam Logeson teaches health policy at Columbia University.
Employers, depending on the generosity of the benefits package, may see their employees choosing to insure themselves through the public system. That would be a real win for small businesses.
Of course, all this depends on the details of any eventual plan, which would still need congressional approval.
I think that there's a degree of pessimism around whether this will go forward, and that's up to the political process.
And the Biden administration is already in a lot of tough political negotiations at the moment. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
a real good week can clean out my warehouse.
Talking supply and demand, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's down 94 points today, about 0.2%, 34,299. The NASDAQ sank 101 points, about 0.7%, 14,072. S&P 500 down 8, about 0.2%, 42.46. The Labor Department's Producer Price Index jumped 0.8% in May. Those are the prices that suppliers charge businesses for various goods. Beef, for instance, as well as furniture and machinery. Supply chain snags and labor shortages are the cause. You know the drill. Oil prices are at a nearly three-year high, now north of $70 a barrel. Vaccine rollouts and higher demand for fuel are among the reasons. ExxonMobil up 3.6% today. Chevron up 0.2%. Bond prices up as well. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note down to 1.49%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Jay Powell tomorrow, as we mentioned up at the top of the program. Inflation, we've already talked about a little bit today as well. So let's take a couple of minutes now and talk about the other part of the Federal Reserve's mandate, maximum employment. Specifically, why said employment isn't picking up a whole lot faster when there are more than 9 million jobs to be had in this economy. Barry Ritholtz runs Ritholtz Wealth Management. He also podcasts for Bloomberg. And he had a blog post the other day about the whole hiring thing that caught our eye. So we got him on the phone. Barry, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks, Kai. It's a pleasure to be here.
We are asking you say the wrong question about so many jobs being available in this economy. Discuss.
Yeah, whenever I hear people say we can't hire people, they're leaving out half of the question, which is at these wages. Hey, you know, ask anybody who's tried to hire and someone eventually says, maybe we need to up our wage offer, and suddenly they're flooded with offers. And we've seen that time and again in this economy.
Take it beyond wage, though. There are some pandemic-specific things that you talk about in this post that are really germane to the future of employment and in some degree, to some degree, wages in this economy. Talk about that.
Sure. So there's two big factors that we're looking at. One is clearly autonomy. And one of the things we learned from the work from home year validated for a lot of corporations who didn't believe it, that employees can manage their time. They can be productive. From the labor side, people have said, you know what? I really like having control to set my schedule. So if I decide that today I'm not going to shave or shower, well, too bad. I'm going to work today in my pajamas. And that level of autonomy is worth a substantial amount. I think that some of the, hey, we've been too generous with unemployment benefits, you can find some examples of where that makes a difference on the periphery. But the flip side to that is the quits rate. Mm. That's telling you this is much more than merely unemployment benefits. And that quits rate, it's at all-time record highs. And that's really quite telling.
All right, so step back for a minute here. And I'm asking you this as a guy who runs his own company, who is the definition of management and capital. You point out in this post, and Neil Irwin's done it in the New York Times as well, the dynamic between capital and labor, you think, is now just fundamentally changed.
Yeah, back in March, I noticed that the balance of power is shifting. And, you know, the pendulum swings back and forth. But there is so much money around, and corporate America has become so large and so profitable that it just reached the point where labor is able to say, hey, you know, I'm not interested in this job. And apparently, neither are most of my peers. So if you want any of us to work for you, you better step up and pay wages.
All right. So look, $64,000 question. Do you think this lasts, or as one imagines, the economy reverts to the mean at some point in the next 18 months to 2 years, does this flip back and capital is in charge again?
So what's been fascinating about wages over time is that they tend to be sticky, which is why it's that stair step up instead of a smooth curve up. So wages go higher. And then if we eventually succumb to the next recession, or I should say when we eventually succumb, people tend not to see their wages cut. What you tend to see is layoffs. People look at wage increases as if they're inflationary, but especially at the lower end of the salary scale, and certainly at minimum wage, it's been lagging the overall economy by so much. It really is sort of a reset to catch up where wages might have been had we had that smooth curve, which, hey, that's unfortunately not how economics works.
Barry Ritholtz, he's co-founder, chairman, also the chief investment officer at Ritholtz Wealth Management. You can catch his podcast at Bloomberg. It's called Masters in Business. Barry, thanks a lot. I really enjoyed talking to you.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Kai.
Okay, cars. We've talked about used cars and their prices. We've talked about semiconductor chips that go in cars and the general disarray in the automotive market right now. This week, then, comes this item. The average age of cars and light trucks in the United States went up during the pandemic. Not a lot, about 2 months. The average age now sits at 12.1 years old. That's according to IHS Market, by the way. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishaw reports, that does not necessarily mean people are hanging on to their clunkers longer or that they even want to.
In general, we are driving cars for longer, and the average car has been getting older for a while now.
And if you go back and look at the data, it's up about 36% over the past 20 years. That's really quite a bit.
Kelsey Mays is assistant managing editor at Cars.com. Cars have gotten safer and more durable over the years. But that's not really why the average car age jumped specifically during the pandemic. For starters, buying a new car wasn't top of mind then, but even if people wanted to, they couldn't because of lockdowns. David Whiston is an equity analyst with Morningstar.
New vehicle sales were down about 14.4% for the year, about around 14.6 million.
So having fewer new cars helped push up the average age of all cars just a little. But also, a lot of cars were taken off the road and out of commission because people just stopped using them, even younger, newer cars. Todd Compo is with IHS Market.
Vehicle owners may have allowed their registrations to lapse because they weren't using their vehicles. They decided that they were going to keep them in the garage and not renew the tags on the vehicle.
This phenomenon was skewed to younger vehicles, and that shows up in the data as a bunch of young cars disappearing from the numbers, which, again, helps push up the average age of all cars. Chances are, those cars will get re-registered, and demand for new cars has built up.
March of 2021 was a record-setting month for new and used sales, and then April followed up with a top 10 month for new sales. And so we think all that's going to combine to keep average age back kind of on the moderate path.
As of last month, used car prices were up 17% since January of 2020. So it's a good time to trade in a used car or, of course, donate it to public radio. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
There's a thing that's been a thing in business for a good 40 or 50 years now, maybe at least. Just-in-time inventory management, it's called. Keep just enough product on the shelves, having gotten it there just in time for customers to buy it. You keep as little inventory on hand as possible. It keeps stuff fresh, reduces waste, cuts down on storage costs. It's kind of a win-win until there's a pandemic. A lot of businesses, big and small, are throwing just-in-time out the window and stockpiling just in case. Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
The grocery store Sahadi's in Brooklyn imports a lot of products from the Mediterranean and the Middle East. And lately, a lot of those products have been taking forever to arrive. Pat Whalen runs the store's shipping and logistics.
I've got import folders. It's hysterical where you see the ETA crossed out, then crossed out again, then crossed out a third time as they're getting stuck.
Whalen says ports are congested. Transportation costs are skyrocketing. Shippers are even having trouble finding containers to move things in.
I had a shipper tell me they have 5 loads to ship to us and they could only get 2 containers. And they won't be able to get the other 3 containers until the end of June.
As a result,
I'm like a lot of the people I work with are now over-ordering and ordering in advance and trying to double and triple up on stuff. So we have a buffer here to manage some of this.
That means Whalen's ordering products today that he'd normally order months from now.
So if I get something 4 months early or 6 months early, who cares? Just get it moving. Don't wait.
But when he gets all of that stuff, he's got to find a place to store it. And that's one reason why building up a buffer like that can be expensive. So some business owners are taking out additional loans.
They need capacity for acquisition of inventory.
Nathan Rogge runs the Bank of Southern California. He says many of the bank's clients have been increasing their lines of credit because their businesses are growing.
They have bigger orders. They're waiting for people who they have sold to pay them back. And in that time frame, they need money to go out and buy more inventory.
Some of them are taking out loans to buy more storage space for all that inventory.
We recently had to purchase a big warehouse.
Eddie Barham is the president of Appliance Home Store in Columbia, South Carolina. He says he's stocking up in part because prices are going up. But he says he also has to make sure he has enough appliances in stock to meet all of the customer demand he's seeing, thanks to government relief checks and a booming housing market.
Some days we'll sell, 30 refrigerators. A real good week can clean out my warehouse.
There are limits on how much inventory businesses can pile up. Brandolyn Green is the founder and CEO of Voice of Hair, a company that sells hair products. She's getting ready to launch a new line of shampoos, conditioners, and styling creams, but she's not stocking up on the ingredients.
I just don't want things to go stale. I want, people to get stuff when it's fresh and new.
What Green is stockpiling is packaging for the new products.
I'm ordering bottles, jars, disc caps, all types of closures to house that product in.
Green says the availability of packaging is determining when she can launch new products. For instance, she launched a line of gummy vitamins for healthy hair because they come in plastic bottles that are easier to get.
Because my tops aren't shiny, they're not metal, they're made out of plastic, and so they're a little bit easier to come by.
In the meantime, Green's stocking up on the fancier, shiny packaging that she plans to use for her shampoos and creams.
So that when the opportunity comes and when I realize that, you know, hey, it's summer, everybody wants a new cleansing shampoo, then I can go ahead and produce that without having to wait.
And once those products launch, Green says she should have enough packaging in store to last 3 to 4 months. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Home Depot says, yeah, no, we're going to do it ourselves, thanks. We have talked global shipping a bit as the recovery has picked up steam, how limited cargo space is and how expensive it is. Well, that explains this quote from the Home Depot chief operating officer this week. We have a ship that's solely going to be ours, he said, and it's just going to go back and forth with 100% dedicated to Home Depot. They're renting their own ship. So take that, I guess. All right, we are going, but here is your moment of economic context. Comes to us today courtesy of the Business Roundtable. We have talked about them before, CEOs of some of the biggest companies in this economy. Here's the news. Their quarterly CEO Economic Outlook survey was out this morning. Long story short, everything is great. Plans for hiring, investment, and sales outlooks are up. Also up, plans for hiring over the next 6 months are at historic highs. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mehmetoglu, Olga Oxman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Star Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.